Dr. Douglas Griffin is currently the lead over at the space missions lead over at the University of New South Wales, Canberra. Doug originally graduated in his PhD over at the University of Queensland, and then he actually went overseas to work in space engineering projects in both Italy and the UK. And Doug's just come back recently to UNSW Canberra to look after the space engineering side. Doug's talk is going to be on the Australian context of trying to do space engineering and make it a sustainable model. So I'll just turn you over to Doug now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wayne. It's very much a pleasure to come here today and to present this talk. I've worked in space for most of my professional career, and it's a thing that I really enjoy doing. So, yeah, thank you very much. So, after completing my undergraduate degree at the University of Queensland, my thesis supervisor back then, Ray Stalker, who I imagine many of you would know, convinced me to prolong my university days and do a PhD in hypersonics. Ray was a leader in his field. He was inspirational, and it was a real privilege to work under him. And unfortunately, he passed away several years ago. During the dog days of my PhD, those days when I was struggling with WordPerfect for Windows 3.0, I had a conversation with Ray, and it's stuck in my mind ever since. It was a casual conversation, and I don't remember the details perfectly, and Ray wasn't in a good mood that day, and he had a pretty pessimistic view of Australia's engagement in technology, and he told me that if I wanted to continue to work in high technology, that I'd have to leave the country and work overseas. So, unfortunately, like many of my friends who did their postgrad, Ray's words were prescient. Literally, the day I submitted my thesis, I boarded a plane here in Melbourne, an Alitalia flight, and flew to Europe, where I worked for 19 years. I had some fantastic opportunities over in Europe to work on space programs and aerospace projects. And they were things that actually flew. They were really real projects in space at the moment. And they were also inspirational things, like working with the European Space Agency Cosmic Vision Program. I wonder, though, today, if Ray was still alive, if he'd give that same advice to his graduating PhD students. Have we moved on? Have we changed the culture as a country? Has the innovation agenda really permeated into society? Had things changed? Well, when Wayne and Eva asked me to give a presentation, they asked me if I had any good ideas of what I could talk about. So there's some really interesting programs that we're starting up at UNSW Canberra, and I would have loved to have spoken about them, but I decided to take a step back and answer the question, what do we need to do to change the situation for the current generation of young engineers and scientists graduating from Australian universities? And how do we get them to apply their skills and their training in high technology here at home? And in particular, how do we go about engineering space flight programs in the Australian context? And how do we ensure that those programs lead to a sustainable future? It's not that Australia has never ventured into the space flight hardware programs. So they've got the notable examples like the FedSat program last decade, and earlier than that we had the ATR instruments, which is an Earth observation instrument that flew on the ERS-1 and the ERS-2 spacecraft. But despite the widely acknowledged successes of these programs, they haven't translated into an ongoing and sustainable space ecosystem within the country. Today, I'd like to talk about some of the ideas and thoughts of how to move from that situation where space flight programs are one-offs in this country to where they occur on a regular basis. And more importantly, those programs contribute to the well-being of the country, easily justifying their investments through returns to the nation's economic development, its well-being, its good management, its contributions to the understandings of science, and its security. So in doing this, I thought it'd be useful to take a step back and look at how some space programs elsewhere have developed and what makes them sustainable today. I'll then analyse those lessons and make some suggestions of how they can be applied in the Australian context. So in my research for this talk, I went back and looked at some of the original documentation from an early space program, and it's the Tiros 1 mission. It was effectively a technology demonstrator for weather spacecraft for today. Although it's hard to imagine that there was a time when forecasting was done without the aid of spacecraft. In the early days, meteorologists had to make do with images like these. To our eyes, they appear to be almost laughably bad quality. But we must remember that in their day, this type of data was revolutionary. The spacecraft itself was pretty rudimentary. The data from the two instruments was recorded onto tape reel and then played back into the transceiver to send it down to the ground station. The data itself was not recorded in digital format, but it remained in analogue all the way through to the ground processing. Even QB-50, or the QB-50 spacecraft we've heard about, or Buccaneer, have far more sophisticated data handling and communication systems to download their telemetry. I had to do a fair bit of research to dig into what the detector was on this spacecraft, and it's called the Vidicon camera tube. I'm surprised if many of you are familiar with the Vidicon technology, and I'd be even more surprised if any of you were considering flying it on a CubeSat. So before coming to UNSW Canberra, I was head of systems engineering at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, just outside of Oxford. As systems engineer, I was part of a team that designed and developed the Spire instrument that flew on the Herschel Space Observatory. This spectacular photo is a composite false colour image of M16, or the Eagle Nebula, which uses Spire data. I'm really proud of this photo, as it represents the fruit of my labours over many years, working on instrument development, testing, and shows that such endeavours are really worth it. This data is revolutionary, but its remarkability is also not just in terms of its beauty, but it shows how far space technology has come since the days of Tiros. When you look at the spacecraft sitting here, acoustic test facility at ESTEC, it's apparent that the spacecraft itself is in a league of its own compared with Tiros. You can see the telescope here. It's a 3.5 metre Ritchie Chretien telescope, and it even today remains as the largest single aperture optical telescope ever flown. What you can't see, however, is the fact that the spacecraft's cryogenically cooled by superfluid helium, protected from the heat of the sun by a large heat shield and solar ray. The telescope itself sits at about 70 Kelvin in flight. But it's not until you get to the heart of the instrument, the detector, that you start to understand how it's possible to obtain exquisite images. The detectors are tiny bolometers suspended on a silicon nitride membrane and cooled to 300 millikelvin. That is just below a third of a Kelvin above absolute zero. And it's only when you do this that you get the sensitivity to be able to acquire images like this and still maintain the imaging performance to achieve the diffraction limit. So you look here at how you do this. This is I believe, the Airbus engineers working on the focal plane instruments, integrating them. The instrument, the Spire instrument I worked on, is up the back here. It's got its red tag cover on. We look at how it was done back in the 60s. Clean room technology was obviously far less advanced back then, but at least they were a lot more stylish than the guys in the bunny suits. So reflecting on this progress leads to my first main point. The progress in capability and the range of space missions that are carried out today can be traced back, in part at least, to technology development. So that's technology push. So Martian rovers, for example, wouldn't be possible without developments in battery technology. Infrared astronomy and space missions would deliver uninspiring results without suitable detector technology. Geostationary communication spacecraft wouldn't work unless you had RF beamforming technology. GPS spacecraft would be utterly useless without ultra-stable atomic clocks. Weather spacecraft would be bogged down with Tiros 1 type performance unless you had attitude control systems that were able to deliver the required pointing stability. Climate measuring spacecraft would be useless unless you had space-grade optics, lasers, that can be used for LiDAR instrumentation. So if technology development has been one of the enablers for space missions elsewhere over the past 60 years. How can we apply those principles here in Australia today? Well, the first principle is that in space, just like any area of technology or science, there's no prizes for reinventing the wheel. It's a great temptation for engineers to put clever widgets together, but when you reinvent the wheel, you do not extend the barriers of what is possible. And it's going to be very difficult to maintain continuity and the right levels of interest to stakeholders here if we're just repeating what's done before. But on a more positive note, I have two suggestions for strategies that can be put together to put innovative missions together. So this is what we can do. Developing space technology in the past has been underpinned by terrestrial technologies, particularly in the areas consumer electronics and photonics. When this technology is suitable for space application, then we can get an enormous opportunity to innovate when we fly it on space missions. One example of the UNSW Canberra space program is a mission that we're working on, but we haven't actually reported it at the meeting. We're developing it in partnership with the UK Space Agency, the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, and the University of Wollongong. And it's a mission to measure the concentration of methane in the upper troposphere and the lower stratosphere. And we're also able, with the mission, to measure the isotopic abundances of carbon-12 and carbon-13, which is important for reasons I won't go into today. The instrumentation payload consists of two laser heterodyne radiometers, and they're compact enough to fit on a 6U CubeSat platform. The mission's really exciting and starting to generate a high level of enthusiasm in the science team. The key point for us today, however, is that this mission is enabled by diode lasers used in fibre optic communication networks on the ground. There's absolutely no way we would have been able to go about putting this mission in place if we had to develop that laser technology from the ground up. So it's a powerful boost and we should use it where possible. The second point that I'd like to make around technology development is Australia is a relatively small nation and we can't be good at everything, but in fact we're really good at some things. And there's pockets of expertise in this country that are truly and unashamedly world-beating. An example of this is in the field of quantum physics. The ARC has just awarded two centres of excellence in this field, one to the CQC2T and another one to the Centre for Engineered Quantum Systems. The completely novel aspects of this science and this engineering is incredible, and the potential is enormous. And applying the cross-disciplinary overlap between quantum on the ground and taking it into space is enormous. UNSW Canberra Space is working with University of Queensland and also colleagues at the National University of Singapore to develop a space-to-space quantum key distribution demonstrator. And if we're successful in doing this, it's going to open the door to secure communications. This collaboration sets the pattern for the types of mission that we want to be engaged in, and we're hoping to increase the level of engagements with groups in the Australian quantum community and help deploy their science and instrumentation on space missions. Coming back to Australia, after working in the European space sector, I quickly realised that the level of infrastructure and just the stuff that's needed to work in space hardware programs is much smaller here. And the reason for that's clear. Historically, Australia's chosen to not heavily invest in space capability, and therefore the networks, the companies, the universities, the organisations haven't grown up around those space programs to the same extent that they have elsewhere. But if we are to establish a self-sustaining national capability here, clearly this is not a good thing and it needs to change. One of the things that's happened in the past 10 years, however, has been the advent of easy and relatively cheap accessibility to launch capacity. So what effect can we expect to see from this change, this easy access to space? Well, during the preparation of the presentation, I've had some interaction with Dr. Nick Stacey from DST Group, and Nick pointed me towards a paper that was published in a journal called The Futurist. And in the article, the authors project the future of nine overlapping technology domains which are responsible for growth of economies in the information age. These technologies fit into two categories: those that have got a modest and steady increase in growth, and those that are disruptive. They have sharp S-shaped curves where they start off slowly, rapidly develop, and then finally become mature and plateau out. So this is a figure that's taken from this paper in The Futurist, and it shows the author's predictions. So we see some of the more modest growth projections, but we also see something that's really interesting for space. So space, they don't know what's going to happen. There's two futures. There's one future where it's modest growth looking forward, and there's another future that with cheap lift or easy access to space, it rockets off. Pardon the pun. Where are we at the moment? Which future is going to turn out? We don't know. But I suspect my indication is that we're somewhere in between, but closer to the higher projections. So this is very good news for us if we want to develop Australian space missions. Another relatively recent change comes from the increased awareness of commercial opportunities in space. Last year, NASA commissioned the Tory Group, who's a consultancy based in Washington, to conduct a survey of the impact of private capital and driving forward the space economy, primarily in the United States, but they also consider the global context. The report's got many interesting insights, but one of the interesting points is the incredible growth in the volume of private investment in space applications this century. But what you can see, it's broken up into three five-year chunks in this century, and down the bottom, that roughly we're doubling the amount of investment every 5 years in space, and it's accelerating. So this leads to my second main point. In order to engineer a sustainable space program in Australia, we need to grow a critical mass of capability and infrastructure. So how do we do this? Well, firstly, we need to ensure that missions and payloads that are proposed and developed in Australia meet real needs, either present or in the future. And this is true if we're competing for research funding or for government funding or commercial funding. If the proposed space activity does not meet this criteria, then it's, unfortunately, I must say that it's ill-conceived and does not justify the investment of our time and our talents to develop them. The second factor is that we're increasingly moving in a world that has free access to markets. That means that we don't have to develop all the capability in Australia to carry out space missions. We need to look to those areas where we are good at and have the capability and tap into them. And where we don't possess those resources, we look elsewhere to supply them from our networks overseas. I think the third lesson, or the third strategy for us to employ, is that we've got a finite set of resources to developing space hardware capability in this country. Therefore, we must maximise potential for working together in collaboration mode, when and where this makes sense, and to cooperate where possible so that we're not working at cross purposes to each other. The last element is the fact that there are commercial opportunities out there for investment in space technology. The money doesn't come for free, and the business case needs to be sound before it can be unlocked. But nonetheless, there is evidence out there that given the right conditions, the private sector can step up to the mark. So during the conference, we've seen some pretty good evidence that Australia is able to launch CubeSats. So we've seen the QB50 programs and Buccaneer. So it's within grasp, that sort of level of activity is in the grasp of the Australian community. And CubeSats are an excellent entry point for new players in spacecraft development because they offer opportunities to operate payloads of ever-increasing complexity and performance. However, the downside of CubeSats is that they're terribly restrictive of what they can do, and some jobs just can't be done with CubeSats. For example, if you're thinking about remote Earth sensing, things like signal-to-noise ratio for an imager are determined by the collecting area of the telescope. If the area of the telescope is too small to catch enough photons to make a statistically significant measurement, then it doesn't matter how good the rest of the instrument is or the rest of the spacecraft is, it's just simply not good enough to do the job. At UNSW Canberra Space, we recognise this and we aspire to a future where we have the capability, the capacity to develop missions that are the next notch up from CubeSat world. Well, how are we going about doing this? the last job I was doing before I came to back to Australia, I was the program manager for the SPICE instrument on the ESA Solar Orbiter spacecraft. In this role, I had to coordinate teams from around Europe, a NASA lab, a US company, to design different parts of the instrument. I had to get the design approved by ESA and then negotiate the interfaces between the instrument and the spacecraft. And that was done with Airbus Defence and Space, mainly in Stevenage in the UK. Doing this type of job has given me a good understanding of how science payloads are designed and developed. And until 1 year ago, Simon Barraclough, who's sitting down in the down there, yep, thank you, Simon Barraclough from Canberra Space, worked at Airbus in Stevenage. He worked on solar orbiter, and he's got a good complementary view of how to implement those missions from the spacecraft perspective rather than the instrumentation perspective. Together, we've got a pretty good and up-to-date understanding of how payloads and spacecraft platforms that are bigger than CubeSats are put together. With this in mind, when I started UNSW Canberra and was thinking about how to build spacecraft larger than CubeSats here, I thought it'd be useful to map out some of the roles and specialisations who we'd be needing in the team. And the way that I did it, the way that I captured this, was in a mind map. What it shows is putting together a space program requires a lot of effort, a lot of specialised skills. You need to put big teams together. And the other thing is that when you put a bigger spacecraft together in particular, there's a big qualitative difference. It's not just the same thing but bigger. What you see here is complexity. So with this growth in complexity, how do you handle it? How can we, in this country, manage the engineering of a complex space programs without them ending in tears? And I think there's some interesting lessons to be learned from other disciplines. When I lived in the UK, I was a keen listener to the BBC Radio 4. Its programming is content based on news and politics, current affairs, history, and a bit of philosophy. Every year, they hold the Wreath Lectures, where a guest is invited to give a series of lectures on the radio on a topic of interest to the nation. And in 2014, the Wreath Lectures, they invited American medic, Dr. Atul Gawande, to talk about some of the challenges facing the future of medicine. In one of the lectures, he spoke about the challenges facing healthcare providers in the 21st century, and those challenges related to complexity, complex systems. And I've got a quote from the lecture that I'll read. So as we embark on the 21st century, we found that the 20th century has given us a volume of knowledge and skill that is beyond what any individual can simply hold in their mind, in their head, can know how to deliver on, or simply do it on their own. The volume of knowledge and skill has exceeded our individual capabilities. So this is exactly the problem that will face us as space engineers and space scientists if we want to take the step from CubeSat components into more complex space systems. So what is Dr. Gawande's solution to this problem? His solution is to put in place the necessary checks and balances into the medical system to ensure that healthcare is delivered to the highest standard. Sounds pretty boring, doesn't it? Well, write a procedure, a checklist, and then follow it. And in his lecture, he speaks about how he gets a lot of pushback from surgeons who see his approach as being bureaucratic and stifling. But his argument in response is that by putting in place the necessary checks and balances into the system, that it's liberating, frees up time and mental space to allow us to be creative. And his argument is that discipline makes daring possible. So in other words, in medicine, space engineering, and any other complex system, we can't just simply make it up as we go. It simply doesn't work. So what's ESA's approach to this? ESA's approach to engineering complex spacecraft is, I guess, embodied in the ECSS standards. These standards fall into four categories. So you've got space program management, space product assurance, space engineering, and space sustainability. And looking around the room, I could imagine that there's going to be a couple of different reactions to a diagram like this. On the one hand, you could say that this collection of standards is very instructive, salutary for a good space program, and must be slavishly followed at all costs. On the other hand, I'm sure some of you are thinking that you'd have to be completely demented to follow such a framework. So the approach that we're taking at UNSW Canberra, and we think it's the right one, is to take a middle ground. And it's what we want to implement in the near to mid-term future in our programs. We shouldn't naively just follow these standards, nor should we throw them out the window, because they're based on the collected experience of space engineers who actually built these systems. The right approach is to critically understand best practice developed elsewhere in the world and apply it when and as useful. During the preparation for this talk, I contacted a systems engineer who I met over 10 years ago, a guy called Robert Halligan from an Australian engineering training company, and he gave me this quote for the talk. And the quote is, "Systems engineering is not a rule book. It's a set of principles and a set of methods. There's almost nothing that we must do in systems engineering. There are things that we choose to do or choose not to do for exactly the same reason, to produce the best outcomes on the balance of probabilities." So this quote nicely captures what we believe is the right approach to engineering space systems in Australia. This leads to the third and final pillar in my model of how to put a space program together in Australia. It's to know, understand, and wisely and judiciously apply the collective wisdom and best practice of space engineering and space engineering management in a calculated manner to our programs. And so here we have the three elements of the model that I'm proposing for how we should go about building space capability in this country. So firstly, with technology development, we must make sure that we're not reinventing the wheel and that there's a component of technology push in what we propose. We need to focus on what we're good at, niche technologies leading to disruptive payloads and mission concepts. So the second one is we have to work on applications where there's real customer need. And it's by doing that will help us to generate the critical mass of capability and break this pattern of one-offs and move into a self-sustaining ongoing program. And then thirdly, when we go about doing those programs, we need to make sure we're going about it in the right way, putting best practice in space engineering, space program management into place. So when Russell Boyce approached me about 18 months ago to see if I was interested in coming back to Australia and work with him to help set up the space group at UNSW Canberra, I remember at the time that I thought it'd be a backward step career-wise. I was head of systems engineering at a major space science laboratory, was getting opportunities to develop some pretty interesting instruments for space science missions. Why would I come back to Australia? Well, Russ is well connected, he's logical, and he's strategic in his thinking, and he walked me through some of the reasons of why space is on the upswing in Australia. His arguments and his vision for what could be achieved made enough sense to me to drag me and the family away from a comfortable existence in England and move to Canberra. The strategies I've outlined are being implemented at UNSW Canberra to build what we hope will be a self-sustaining program. The team of engineers and space scientists are growing in number and expertise, and collectively we've got the experience to implement some of this vision. Although I'm impatient, so far my expectations for how quickly things would develop have been exceeded. It's a really exciting time to be working in space in Australia, and I hope that we generate the good news stories and build on successes so that we can offer a model to other groups in Australia who want to work in the same direction. So, back to the start. I wonder if Ray was alive today, what advice he'd give to PhD students. Would he encourage them to up sticks and go overseas to stay in high technology? Well, I hope if he was able to hear the talk today that he'd say no, stick in Australia and work in space. Thank you.